I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Greetings from the Hill Country of Central Texas. This is Revolution of Military Affairs, and I'm your host, Amos Fox. All right. Good morning or good afternoon, depending on what time zone you're in. Where I'm at, it's still quite early. Still dark, in fact. But today on the podcast, we have Abby Zeith, who works at the International Committee for the Red Cross out of Geneva, Switzerland. And so that's why I say afternoon, because it's afternoon for her. But anyhow, she is the legal advisor at the Arms and Conduct of Hostilities Unit at the ICRC's legal division. And so we're going to talk today about urban warfare and sieges, more, I think, from a theoretical standpoint than an applied standpoint for the most part. But we wanted to talk, or I wanted to talk with her about this because we've had experience working together in the past. We've participated in a conference together at Harvard University that was really, really insightful on sieges right at the beginning of February, or it was, I guess, March, April 2022, right after Russia had invaded Ukraine. And so it was very timely. And so I really appreciated Abby's perspective on things. I've heard her on a couple of other podcasts too. So I think it's her perspective and her outlook is very important, and her knowledge just on the rules of war and international humanitarian law. So for that reason, I want to have her on the podcast. So, Abby, thank you for coming on the podcast today.
Thanks so much for having me, Amos.
So if you would, Abby, before we get started, just give a brief overview on what the ICRC is and what its mandate is.
Yeah, no worries. So the International Committee of the Red Cross, well, we were established in 1863. We are a neutral, independent, and impartial humanitarian organization operating worldwide in more than 100 countries, also helping people that are affected by conflict and armed violence. And in doing that, a big part of our role is promoting the laws that protect victims of war. So, you know, we call it international humanitarian law. In many militaries, we'll call it LOAC, or the law of armed conflict. And so in terms of, you know, where our mandate comes from, you know, we are not part of the UN. We are sort of a very separate organization. And our mandate actually comes from the Geneva Conventions themselves and the additional protocols, as well as the statutes of the Red Cross and Red Crescent movement. So we are part of, the ICRC is part of a broader international movement, or an umbrella, under the umbrella of it. And so we work alongside and very closely with with national societies, in particular countries where we operate, who are often, you know, the first responders in armed conflict.
So for folks that aren't aware, the ICRC also, if you go on their website, it has all the answers to all your questions about international humanitarian law in terms of like what does the law actually say. And there's just a plethora of very, very useful information, both from the scholarly side, also from the analyst side, also from the military practitioner side. So if you're looking for good information on what are the rules of war, using air quotes on that phrase there, and just a lot of good case study work, the ICRC's website provides a lot of that. So with that, today we're going to jump into a discussion on urban warfare and sieges, I think, in particular, to a degree. And so urban warfare, we're going to talk about that because it's become, again, it's quite prevalent today. And there's a lot of several good reasons for why it's become so prevalent today. And the challenges associated with that, not necessarily from the military side, but from the civilian and protection of civilian side, which is where Abby's expertise comes in today. So with urban warfare, I think I'm just going to throw a couple ideas out and then I'm going to pass it over to you, Abby. But urban warfare, you know, Anthony King's written quite a bit of really good work on why urban warfare is so prevalent today and why it's going to be even more prevalent in the future. And there's really, I think, two big conditions that Tony points out that are useful to highlight for our discussion this morning. One is that the size of military forces is constricted. They've gotten quite smaller, since the end of the Second World War, for example. And so a lot of urban warfare wasn't really noted during the Second World War, as Tony points out, because forces were so big that urban environments were just consumed in a small part of a bigger front that militaries operated on. And so you didn't necessarily hear about these big urban battles, unless that urban battle was the operation itself, right? Like Stalingrad or Leningrad or something like that. There's that component, right? And then the other component is that cities are getting larger, right? So you've got smaller forces and larger cities. And those two things work together almost in tandem with one another to have this reciprocal effect, creating urban warfare being what it is today in terms of its prevalence and whatnot. Is there anything else on your side, Abby, that you've seen that relates to the contribution of urban warfare becoming so popular? And then what are some of the things from the civilian side that you think are important to note about urban operating environments that don't necessarily apply to, say, fighting out in the open desert?
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't think I can add much more beyond what you already said, Amos, in terms of the reasons why fighting comes to the city a lot of the time. I mean, it's you know, as you said, yeah, demographics, you know, the strategic value of cities, and, you know, the size, you know, strategies that end up drawing fighting into an urban area, of which, you know, that has to do also with force size, you know, combat density, like sort of the point Anthony King makes in his excellent book and, you know, in line with a number of the points you've made in some of your great stuff that I've read. I mean, in terms of the, you know, civilian harm that's caused, you know, by fighting in cities, well, there is a lot of it. It is one of the most devastating, you know, forms of fighting for civilians. Of course, it's also the same. That's also the case for combatants. But you know, from our side, you know, particularly in the last few decades, you know, we've continued to see urban warfare cause, you know, widespread death, injury, and destruction. You know, whether it be, you know, we see a lot of the use of heavy explosive weapons in urban areas, which causes significant harm. We, particularly when it comes to besieged urban areas, we see challenges in terms of getting commodities into the area that you need for civilians to survive, essentially. You know, it's sort of, whether it be from the bombardments themselves, but, you know, also your checkpoints and restrictions of movement, counter mobility activities, you know, restrictions on humanitarian aid, just some examples. Some of the other big challenges in terms of when fighting comes to city has to do with the severe disruptions to essential services that happens. So, you know, we think of electricity, healthcare, water and sanitation, and food production and distribution as some examples. And the disruptions can come from for a range of reasons. You know, one example being obviously damage to the critical infrastructure that's needed to for essential service delivery. We also see essential services being deliberately denied as part of a belligerence warring strategy. There are also challenges we face when essential service personnel are either harmed or prevented from doing their job, because without them, we don't have anybody to repair or maintain the infrastructure that's needed for essential service delivery. And then the other big challenge is, you know, a lack of having the spare parts and consumables that you need to maintain critical infrastructure and getting them into the area. So that's a huge challenge. And then, you know, I think you said on a podcast episode, I can't remember which one, you said the first rule of war is don't die. Yeah. And in that sense, the same goes for civilians. You know, we have civilians that are forced to make really impossible choices with, you know, the little food and water and healthcare that they have available, particularly when urban fighting becomes quite protracted. And, you know, they have to, you know, they will face, you know, consequences that are often cumulative and long lasting and not always visible. So, you know, particularly in besieged and encircled urban areas, you know, we hunger, dehydration, illness and disease, you know, and death, obviously. So, but when we talk about, you know, I think you've mentioned it before and you've put it in your writing in a number of your publications that, when it comes to urban sieges, there are consequences that occur beyond the besieged area itself. And I think you said something to me in Cambridge a couple of years ago that really stuck with me, because I think it summed it up perfectly. I think you said, like the squeezing of a balloon, a siege in one location redistributes misery and suffering to other locations. And in that sense, you know, in urban areas, when, you know, we see mass displacement from those areas. People are kind of, you know, they lose their homes and their livelihoods. They're uprooted from their communities. So they are often forced to sort of go to other areas or and depend upon host families and communities that, you know, at a time when those hosts themselves are already being impacted by the conflict, which is something that we saw, you know, that was, for example, if we look at Mosul, you know, there were large influxes of people from urban areas that exacerbated already pre-existing problems in the neighborhoods that they were displaced to. Yep. And I think, you know, and the other thing to bear in mind is that, you know, once the fighting is over, those that are displaced from urban areas are often prevented from returning. And that's sometimes for years. It can be, you know, often to, you know, the explosive remnants of war or unexploded ordnance that's left over, you know, lack of essential services or an inability to restore them, you know, to an acceptable level, or they just simply have no homes to go to. So, and I think the other really important point to bear in mind is, you know, for when it comes to urban sieges in particular, you know, no two sieges look the same. Yep. And the humanitarian conditions themselves are going to depend on a range of factors. And that can, you know, depend on the intensity and the location of the fighting, the nature of the movement restrictions that are being imposed upon civilians, what kind of coping mechanisms they have available themselves, and then the extent to which humanitarian aid can actually enter into the area, as well as things like prevalence of, you know, smuggling and bribery. So there's a lot of humanitarian concerns. And often those consequences really do exceed that which humanitarian action alone can fix, which is why we continue to advocate for preventing the harm in the first place as much as you can.
As you were talking through that, and then your last point specifically also makes me want to ask this follow-up question to what you just described. So have you seen anything that says that precision strike strategies are actually any better quantitatively than non-precision strike strategies at preventing civilian casualties, the destruction of essential services, etc.?
Yeah, it's a big question, Amos, and I know that you've I think you wrote a very interesting piece on the precision paradox.
Mm-hmm.
Precision guidance is undoubtedly an improvement over inaccuracy. From a risk assessment perspective, of course, you know, PGMs are going to be a better option than unguided weapon systems. And in some cases, if those PGMs are available for you to use in certain circumstances, using them might be actually a legal obligation to do so. But at the same time, you know, simply using precision weapons doesn't automatically ensure more limited damage per se, you know. So they just minimize the area that's at risk of being impacted by a munition's direct effects. So, you know, from a legal perspective, not every precision attack is going to comply with IHL, and they don't eliminate the dangers for civilians, completely in urban areas. You know, mm-hmm. That's going to depend on, you know, the size of the bomb you're using, yep. You know, how accurate, you know, the type of intelligence that you're using in terms of, you know, what you're targeting. I mean, one of the biggest challenges is target misidentification.
Yeah, for sure.
As I'm sure you know, inadequate collateral damage assessments. It also depends on the nature of the target. You know, we talk, and you mentioned, you know, you asked me just before about, you know, critical infrastructure. Even if there's certain infrastructure that might be targeted because it's being used by the enemy, the indirect effects that can reverberate for civilians is significant. You know, mm-hmm. We can think of things like if you target energy infrastructure, you know, energy infrastructure is essential for the functioning of other critical services. So, and often, in many of the cities where we operate, there are not a lot of redundancies built into energy infrastructure. So if you go after that, the civilian harm risks are huge. So I guess, and there are a number of other factors that can impact, you know, how effective a PGM is and the risks of civilian harm. But yes, I guess the question that you're asking me is really, you know, does it make a difference if you use precision weapons across an urban battle space if at the end result is you're destroying the entire urban area? And I mean, yeah, it's a really important thing to be considering. You know, it's not going to reduce the civilian harm if you're using precision across an entire battle space. It's also very expensive.
Yep.
In the end, the consequences we're left with look very similar to what you see in the Second World War, and the aftermath of that is significant, and you know, can take years to decades to rectify.
I agree with you. I think that it's also there's an interesting dichotomy perhaps emerging now too with PGMs, because to this point, PGMs and precision strike really, you know, if we're talking about true contemporary PGMs, like they've only really been used in this counterinsurgency, you know, post 9/11 type scenario where it was essentially chasing individual bad guys or small groups of bad guys and targeting that way. And using precision strike in that capacity, which, as we've seen, even at the tail end of the war in Afghanistan, we didn't always get right. And we're transitioning from that to how do you use PGMs in this large-scale combat operations type scenario. And I don't think that we fully appreciate that. I think Mosul, perhaps, and a lot of these battles in Syria and battles in the Philippines, you know, and to a lesser degree, what we've seen in Ukraine, provide a glimpse into what that might look like. But as you said, you know, the costs, they're going to be cost prohibitive. And so using those on a wide scale capacity in the future in a large scale combat operations type scenario, I think is something that'll be interesting to see how that plays out, because I don't know that the industrial base for anybody is going to be well suited to use those in the same way that they've been used before during that post 9/11 period. So I think that's something that will play a significant role in how civilians and critical infrastructure are addressed in future wars. There was something else on that too that I think is important to note too when we talk about civilian casualties and services and whatnot. And that's, you know, talking again about this dichotomy between the counterinsurgency type approach and then the large scale combat operations type approach. In that counterinsurgency type approach, what you have is PGMs chasing combatants around the battlefield, whereas in the large scale combat operations scenario, I think it'll be interesting to see how those two things split. But at the end of the day, I don't know that it would be interesting if there was a way, and I guess maybe this is for the people out there that make war games and simulations and whatnot, if there's like a rewind button in the simulations to where you can put in like a PGM-based strategy and then replay it with a non-PGM-based strategy and then look at the differences and how that plays out. But moving on from that, so you've mentioned sieges a good bit here, and I think we'll use the rest of our time here to talk a bit about sieges. And so one of the important things that I think to note for all the listeners, and I've mentioned this before on this podcast, is that sieges are a thing, right? We're doing them again, we being just everybody, you know, armed conflict in general. Sieges are a thing that have been recurrent, especially in the post, and I've done some analysis on the post-Cold War period. In the post-Cold War period, sieges are actually very prevalent. And so it's important to note that sieges, A, aren't a way of warfare, this is how, you know, we fight purely in sieges and this is how we do it. Sieges are a tool, right? They're a thing that somebody does, an actor does, based off a variety of conditions. And sometimes it's not even something that they do based off choice. It's almost just they kind of accident their way into it based off an emerging situation. You either, you know, you find yourself encircled in a city or you find yourself encircling somebody as a response to some sort of stimulus, encircling them in a city. And so, you know, again, as I've mentioned before, looking at the data, and I'll ask you, Abby, if you've seen any other data on this, because I'm happy to share data if possible, even though I don't think I could, my data set was too big to share with you. But I accounted for 60 sieges in the post-Cold War period up to today. That doesn't count for what's going on in Gaza right now, just because I had kind of froze that data set in place as I started working on getting the papers and a chapter in my book tied to that as well. But 60 sieges in the post-Cold War period. Couple of points that I want to note on that real quick too is that overall what I found and when looking at sieges is that 60% of the time of those 60 sieges, the aggressor won, the defender won 30% of the time. And then, you know, that remaining 10% split across different breakdowns of actor types. And then from there within that data, also I broke it into four time periods, right? 0 days to 1 month. And then 1 month to 6 month time period, then 6 month to 12 month, and then beyond a year, right? And so within that, there was some interesting stuff that emerged as well. So most of the sieges actually fell within that 1 to 6 month time period, but then the second highest frequency was beyond a year. And then within that, 90, so on that 0 to 1 month scale, 90% of the time the aggressor won, and that 1 to 6 month scale, 57% of the time the aggressor won. But the interesting thing that I found that I wasn't expecting is in that 6 to 12 month time period, the defender wins 55% of the time, which I thought was quite unique, and I wasn't expecting to find that at all. And then beyond 12 months, 61% of the time, the aggressor wins. And so I think that's important to understand, not because it's just cool data to have, but because it can kind of help us see how things might affect, how sieges, urban warfare, and then if they devolve into sieges or if sieges emerge from within there, what we can think about when we think about civilian harm and damage to cities. And so, Abby, have you seen anything else in your research that any other data that you think is interesting or useful or helpful to think about when we think about sieges in particular?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, Amos, I've been reading and following your writings on siege for a while now. I've always enjoyed chatting with you about it. I mean, I think you're one of the few people coming out with the good data to reflect upon in terms of how often sieges or particularly urban sieges are happening, on today's modern battlefield. I mean, we've certainly, from our experience at the ICSC, we've seen, firsthand the impacts of siege or urban sieges, in every region in recent years. And so there's a lot of, there's a lot of organizations that have published data on the civilian harm that's caused from siege and encirclement in various aspects. And one example coming immediately to mind was PAX. I mean, PAX did an interesting published a lot, I think, during as part of the sieges in Syria. I think they called it Siege Watch. And there's a lot of other NGOs and academics who are sort of writing about some of the humanitarian consequences, which is very important to bear in mind when doing sort of thinking about siege and how to conduct them in a way that best mitigates civilian harm.
You mentioned humanitarian consequences and the connection between that and the siege. And I think it's important to point out really quick, there's a couple of different types of sieges too, generally speaking, broad brushstroke. And I think I'll mention these and then ask you what different considerations you think are associated with each one. And I'll run through the list really quick. So there's three that I've identified. And again, so there's the open siege. These are the sieges where there's an artery or some sort of artery left open to the outside world from the besieged area, whether intentionally or unintentionally. So on an intentional standpoint, that may be because the besieger is trying to adhere to IHL, right? Civilians need to be able to come and go from the besieged area, whereas the military, the rules are slightly different. So they've left an artery open, right, on purpose. There's also situations where they may leave an artery open for intelligence gathering purposes, right? So they can see where, military support is coming and going from to the besieged actor within that siege, or they just don't have sufficient force to actually completely encircle an opponent in a given locale. There's also the closed siege, right, which is full encirclement, complete isolation. There's no artery into or out of the besieged area.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And so the considerations there, I think are the area under siege is relatively small, or the force doing the siege is relatively large in relation to the area under siege, right? And so those are two, I think, the two most dominant views in most people's minds, right? And I think a lot of times too, when they think about the sieges, really, and when you say that word and people say closed siege is what really comes to mind, but I think more often than not, the open siege is what reality really shows. And then this is something that I've updated on my own based off just observation over the past couple years, is the idea of a loose siege. And I think a loose siege is where you're surrounding an adversary is surrounded by fires, but not necessarily the physical and physical encirclement or isolation of a city. But the city itself may be surrounded by sufficient fires that it creates a nominal siege in that general area, right? So it's surrounded by fires. There's free-floating fires into that area, but the physical force may not be on the ground. And so as I was reflecting a while back on this, the battle for Kyiv at the beginning of the Russo-Ukrainian War was really what came to mind. Essentially, it's, you know, an MLRS artillery, extended range artillery type siege of an area where you didn't physically, they didn't, you know, in this case, the Russians didn't physically control the shoulders and, you know, nodes into and out of Kyiv, but they had the ability, theoretically, which ended up, they didn't really do a good job of doing this, but they had the, you know, the ability to dominate that area with fire. So, based off those definitions, Abby, have you seen anything that's that shows different humanitarian law considerations in either of those situations?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, and I think probably it sort of illustrates some of the, you know, the IHL considerations, and then compare them with the scenarios that you've spoken about just before. I think it's good to maybe, you know, trace a little bit how the legal framework governing sieges has evolved over the years. You know, if we think back to the, you know, the Middle Ages, there really was quite a rigid set of customs about how a fortified city was to be attacked, you know, how that city might respond, and then what, you know, its inhabitants can expect if the city was captured. And then, you know, the besieged sort of city was given certain degrees of immunity depending on the timing of which they capitulated. So, you know, the quicker they capitulated to a besieging army, then the greater immunity they received. But if a defending city itself refused an initial sort of summons to surrender, then no future mercy was guaranteed. So, you know, much of the responsibility was on the defender, and there was a high price paid for resistance. And back then, in those types of sieges, the harm to civilians, you know, starvation, bombardment, and pillage was really thought to be an incidental but not an unlawful effect of warfare. You know, in those complete isolation kind of, you know, circumstances where they just simply can't leave and the siege is conducted indiscriminately. Now, if you fast forward a little bit to the 19th and 20th centuries, the situation from a legal perspective hadn't improved much for civilians. You know, there were rules and customs of war that really still deemed it lawful to starve besieged civilians and combatants indiscriminately. We know at Nuremberg, for example, the court itself considered it an extreme but not unlawful measure to employ artillery against civilians in order to drive them back into a besieged area in order to hasten the surrender of an adversary. Now, today, that would clearly be a war crime because, you know, the law has significantly changed, you know, since then. And it is clear that the type of siege warfare that fails to discriminate between civilians and enemy and armed forces is effectively prohibited today. And that's because there has been a number of international law developments that have significantly restricted what belligerents can do during urban sieges. And I'm not going to go into too much detail on that because I might lose some of your listeners here, but I'll share some more detailed publications with you in case you want to drop it into the show notes. But I think the bottom line up front from a legal perspective is that, you know, today sieges must be directed exclusively against an enemy's armed forces. And IHL offers really important protections to civilians that are trapped in besieged areas. You know, firstly, civilians must not be trapped in sieges, and both parties must allow civilians to leave the besieged area when it is necessary to spare them from the effects of the hostilities themselves, but also when civilians lack goods that are essential for their survival. And that includes when a siege itself involves the use of starvation of combatants as a method of warfare.
Yep.
The second important point is that, you know, although temporary evacuations might be necessary and even legally required, sieges must not be used to compel civilians to permanently leave an area. And then in that sense, IHL offers really strong protections to civilians that are fleeing or evacuating. So obviously, unlike the situation, you know, Second World War, you know, you can't attack civilians. You can't launch artillery at them to keep them in a besieged area. You have to ensure that any displacement of civilians that are fleeing or evacuating is only temporary. They have a right to voluntary return after the, once the reasons for their displacement cease to exist. And then once, you know, those folks that are displaced from urban areas or urban sieges, all possible measures need to be taken to ensure that they receive, you know, satisfactory conditions of shelter and hygiene, safety and nutrition, and that no family members are separated. And that's just a few examples. So that's for, you know, and then the other key point is for civilians that, for whatever reason, remain in besieged areas, they must be protected. So, you know, belligerents, whether it be besieged or besieging forces, are bound by all of the rules that, you know, concern, you know, how you conduct your hostilities, particularly the targeting rules. And we can think of, you know, distinction, proportionality, mm-hmm. and precautions being the main principles. But then in addition, you know, the law of armed conflict has important rules on starvation and on humanitarian relief that are designed to ensure, in combination, that civilians are not deprived of supplies essential to their survival or they're made to starve. And so, and then there, of course, you know, I can go into more detail on how humanitarian relief operations work and the rules apply there. But really, I guess the point I want to get at is that, you know, this idea that, you know, complete isolation that, you know, in a siege is, you know, permissible just simply doesn't stand anymore. You know, civilians have to be able to leave a besieged area if they wish. You have to, you know, protect civilians that are trapped within besieged areas, and that includes by allowing humanitarian relief in. So, you know, and it's, and that's a, you know, some particularly important messages that we emphasize here, because we do hear from some folks in militaries that, you know, isolation is, you know, the only priority when conducting a siege. But as I think you've said in one of your own pieces on this, you know, you can't consider isolation in a vacuum. You know, the law has evolved, you know, societal expectations have evolved. And, you know, you have to ensure that civilians that are trapped in sieges or displaced from them are adequately protected.
Yeah, I think that also ties back to something that you'd mentioned earlier when you mentioned the squeezing of the balloon and how we talk about that. You know, the area under siege isn't necessarily just the only place that's affected by a siege. And you can go back and look specifically for some more near-term examples at, you know, the siege of Ilovaisk, during the Donbass campaign, that 2014-2015 time period in the Russo-Ukrainian War, where it wasn't just the area under siege, you know, like Ilovaisk itself that was smashed during that period, but the arteries inside and outside, not inside, the arteries, the nodes outside the city that supported operations inside the city from both sides, were also attacked in that situation and caused a lot of damage there. And you saw the same thing at both the Baltava, but also Donetsk Airport, like the small town of Pisky. Again, I'm horrible with pronouncing Ukrainian words and town names, but, you know, it was a small town just outside Donetsk Airport. I think it was like 2.5 miles away, but it changed hands several times itself between the Russians and the Ukrainians because it was a support node for the city. But then it was also for the siege of Donetsk Airport. But it was also essentially a casualty collection point for the Ukrainians, as they would bring forces out of the city when they had the opportunity to. And so I think that's something to keep in mind when we talk about that idea of isolation of an area, but then also the effects of allowing the city to remain open or to have an artery that goes out, right, for civilians. That there are also nefarious actors within the world, as we've seen some of the heinous things that have occurred in Syria and other places throughout the conduct of war in the past, 20 years, where they may use that information also to continue targeting civilians, even though it is illegal. And I think that's just something to consider for really just about anybody that's involved in this space, whether it's policymakers, practitioners, whatnot, analysts, that those positions in and around sieges in which civilian populations are allowed to go to can also become points of contention based off the type of adversary that's involved in that conflict. So I think that's something good to keep in mind as we think about that. And then the last point I want to make real quick is, you talk about the rules of sieges back in back when siege warfare was an actual form of warfare. And it's, Tony King, I was doing research quite a while ago, and I'd asked Tony about, some references on positional warfare and anything he had on sieges. And he recommended David Chandler's The Art of War in the Age of Marlborough. And that book goes through in details, like the math that these, like Vauban and all these people during that time period associated with how to conduct sieges, and how Marlborough and his engineers had sieges. So it's certainly changed quite a bit, and the rules are vastly different than what they once were. But anyway, with that, Abby, we're getting close on time here. Is there anything else that you want to mention that we haven't talked about as it pertains to urban warfare, sieges, protection of civilians, IHL, anything?
Yeah, I mean, I think really just to kind of stress, the importance of military's thinking about, the reality of, contemporary siege and encirclement and in urban areas, because, as you've said, I think time and time again, there isn't enough, there aren't enough people talking and thinking about this in terms of, why these things are conducted, how they are conducted and how to best, reduce the civilian harm that is often a cause for it. So, and I think continuing to have those conversations from a multidisciplinary perspective is really important, which is why I really thought the Harvard workshop a couple of years ago was so good. I think probably some of my, in terms of some of the things that would be important for the ICRC in terms of, trying to reduce the civilian harm caused by siege and encirclement is, trying to find ways to better mitigate the risks of harm caused by, bombardment and heavy explosive weapons in these contexts. I mean, there's a lot of work that's been done around this, both, the ICRC has been working a lot on and advocating for change in this respect of, across a number of years. We've seen, 83 states, including the US, make political commitments to try and address the direct and indirect harm caused by these things in urban areas, as well as, the more recent the U.S. Civilian Harm Mitigation Response Action Plan that's also focuses on some of those issues. I think for the ICRC, I guess our two big, the two couple of things that we really are focusing on in addition to, the heavy explosive weapons piece is working on ensuring the resilience of essential services in the areas that, militaries are operating. I mean, protecting and restoring, maintaining essential services is something that the movement and in particular the ICRC and our national societies have been focused on for a long time. I said before, the most essential services that are out there include, drinking water, which preparing that is complex. There's challenges because there is a tendency to centralize those things. Emergency sources of water are not often available. It's energy mm-hmm. intensive, and there's a lot of consumables and logistics that are required. I've talked yeah. about the importance of energy, sanitation, and solid waste as well. Disruptions in those services has caused significant risk of infectious disease and long-lasting groundwater contamination. And so, we talk about how all of these services are interdependent, which means that the collapse, the failure of one can result in the collapse of many. And, when systems like this fail, the scale of the consequences, like I said earlier, they really do exceed anything that humanitarians alone can address. I think the average length in which the ICSC, you know, the ICC is often, you know, when in every different, in every sort of conflict there is, but, you know, we don't leave after it finishes and we're there for decades. The average length of time at which we're there is, you know, around 40 years or so. So, you know, we spend a long time trying to fix these essential service systems alongside partners, and it's a very difficult task. And so what we do advocate is for militaries to do more to anticipate, prevent, and respond to the impacts of their operations on essential service delivery. You know, there are improvements that can be made in terms of doctrine and planning. You know, particularly from when it comes to targeting is a big one there. But then equally, you know, we can't just focus on, you know, infrastructure itself. We've got to focus on the people and the consumables that are needed for essential service functioning. And then the absolute, you know, importance of preserving the humanitarian space for humanitarians, you know, also essential service personnel to get into areas where you need to restore essential services, which is a big challenge in besieged and encircled areas. So, yes, ensuring the resilience of essential services is one huge point. And then the other one that I'd like to say is probably, you know, militaries need to do more to train and prepare for organized civilian evacuations from urban areas, in particular besieged areas, because, you know, we've seen time and time again that those types of operations are fraught with dilemmas for both militaries and humanitarians alike, and no two contexts are the same. And things go wrong pretty easily when evacuations are badly organized, when there are coordination issues, when you don't have consent and agreement between the warring parties themselves causes a huge challenge.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, in that vein, militaries need to do more to understand the role that humanitarian actors might play at the various stages of an evacuation, you know, and understand those organizations' red lines and conditions for involvement in those operations. So, like, as a neutral and impartial humanitarian intermediary, the ICSC has, you know, facilitated safe passage of civilians out of besieged areas, you know, for a very long time. You know, most recently, you know, we've got examples from Ukraine to Syria. You know, but they, you know, we've got examples dating back to the Spanish Civil War. And, you know, these types of safe passage measures, you know, they have to be well planned. They have to be implemented with the agreement of the parties of the conflict. And you need to ensure the safety of those evacuees and humanitarian personnel that are involved, because the operations, even when you do have agreement between the parties, are extremely complex and dangerous.
Yeah.
And they have major risks for the affected population. And so they've got to be managed. Now, you know, they are challenges to plan and train for, of course. And, you know, we've seen through our work on urban warfare that, you know, many militaries don't have, some of them don't even have urban warfare doctrine, and yep. and the limited urban warfare doctrine that does exist doesn't say a lot about humanitarian or civilian harm risks. And this is something that we've been working on for a long time, engaging with states and non-state armed groups on particular ways in which they can, reduce the harm caused by their operations. And I think now, a couple of years ago now, we published a handbook for commanders on how to reduce civilian harm in urban warfare. And that's sort of aimed at, you know, battalion to brigade level sort of planning, and it's sort of offering a number of suggestions on some of the humanitarian considerations that can be taken into account for training and planning and conduct. And it has a couple of good annexes on things like evacuations, working with humanitarian actors, screening processes that, you know, might be undertaken when civilians are fleeing from besieged areas. So really important considerations, those types of operations during siege and encirclement. And I guess one of the big messages is, I guess, or things that we'd like to sort of, you know, encourage militaries to do is to think more about incorporating these considerations into their training and planning.
a comment on that, and then I'm going to close up here with two other points. But the comment on what you just said is, I think part of the challenge that militaries find too, at least in my own experience with the doctrine I'm most familiar with, is that, A, you are correct, there is very little urban warfare, urban operations doctrine, and what is there is in many cases, it reflects a cultural bias against the realities of urban warfare. So it may talk about operations in an urban environment, but it may not talk about the types of things you're really going to have to do, right? So like sieges, right? We don't want to use that word because it just sounds corny and old and out of fashion, right? But in reality, it's really a thing. And so there's a separation within doctrine of the reality of urban operations and urban operations and how they're published. But then also, I think the challenge is a lot of militaries view a lot of the things that you've talked about in terms of military forces and their relationship with the civilian population and non-combatants in urban operations. They view that as stability operations. And so because, as I was once told, English-speaking people like to really break things into boxes and separate things into categories. There's not a good crossover between stability operations, if you want to classify the things that you've identified, right? The mitigating civilian harm and all those things, moving military forces, helping with the extraction of civilian populations from areas under siege and things like that. You know, if that does fall into that way that stability operations have been characterized, then that term stability operations probably isn't useful, nor is that dichotomy between those different things useful, and it just needs to be batched together. And then within there, a lot of the discussions on stability operations are overly generic and don't place the thing, the operation in context of an environment. Or if it does, it's all, you know, because I think a large part of Western militaries specifically are bound by this 20 years of post 9/11 GWAT global war on terrorism bias that they have. So when they talk about that, it's in the context of some sort of insurgency counterinsurgency dynamic and not necessarily the rigorous operating environment of a urban warfare or an urban siege. And so I say all that to say just my two closing points here. I think it's important to note that just because it doesn't sound cool, right? So just because sieges don't sound cool and they sound old and antiquated and like we're not looking forward and thinking futuristically about warfare, just because it doesn't sound cool doesn't mean we don't need to think about it and we don't need to understand it and we don't need to incorporate it, like you said, into doctrine and in planning. So that's point number one. Point number two is just because you don't think that you do it, despite evidence to the contrary in many cases, but and you being whomever, right? Pick your state, pick your military force, doesn't matter. Just because you don't think that you do it doesn't mean that you don't. Also doesn't mean that you're not going to encounter it on the battlefield, because odds are you probably will. Again, going back to that data set that I've been building out, like I would argue you probably will encounter sieges. And more frequently you'll see urban warfare, but within that you'll certainly see sieges as well. And so just because you don't think that you do it or you don't think that it matters doesn't mean that you don't need to understand it, which gets back to your point on doctrine and planning and getting those things incorporated across the board. So those are my two big takeaways, I think, for today is that. And so, Abby, with that, I just want to close up here and thank you for your time. I appreciate you dialing in and meeting with me here. And again, thank you very much for your time. It's always enjoyable talking to you. I always learn a lot just because you have a different perspective on this than I do. So I appreciate it. And thank you very much.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Amos. I mean, yeah, right back at you. I really enjoy listening to your podcast and I love reading your stuff. You're teaching me something new every time. And, you know, just to you can fully agree with you on the points, the last couple of points you just made. I mean, the future of warfare will be in urban areas and civilians are always going to be there. And, you know, like you say, I think in all of your episodes or in a number of your episodes, you know, just because it's in doctrine or it isn't always the reality that you face, you know, in the actual battle space. And so being realistic about your training that does incorporate civilian harm considerations is absolutely key for us.
All right. Well, with that, thanks, Abby. And hopefully we'll have you back on soon.
Thanks, Amos.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.